That's the guitar I have right now. I'm in the process of getting a proper acoustic guitar. The one that you've seen in this podcast many times before is actually like broken. It always has been.
Oh. It always has been and always will be.
Yeah. So I have made the commitment to get it doesn't have to be super fancy, you know, but just like a decent playing guitar, you know. Sam has that traveling one, that little Taylor that I really, really like. But I don't know if I need a Taylor. Yeah.
Jake, you deserve the best.
I'm going to get the best, Nico. I'm
going to
get a Martin.
An Ibanez.
I mean,
I'm going to get honestly, an Ibanez, the best.
I think once you hit 30, there's one thing in life just save up some money for and spend it on. It's a good instrument. Assuming you play instruments. If you've been playing instruments up to this point and you still haven't stopped, now's the time to buy a nice one.
That's true. I have been playing instruments since I've been playing guitar since I was 12 up to this point, and I haven't really stopped.
And if you don't play an instrument, get an instrument when you're 30 because your friends will think you're cool.
Hey.
Yeah.
But don't get an expensive one.
No. So get an Ibanez.
I'll wait 3 years and then I'll learn an instrument. Yeah. Because right now definitely. I have smooth brain, no instrument knowledge.
Dude,
right now,
what a plan, Matt. Yeah. That's a great plan.
Yeah. It's the midlife crisis plan.
Knowing an instrument takes the wrinkles off your face and puts them in your brain.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well said.
Wow. I don't even know what that means, but it sounds interesting.
Keeps you youthful and makes you smarter.
Oh, okay. Okay. There you go.
You need to wrinkle your brain a little bit more, it sounds like.
Clearly.
Get them brain wrinkles, son.
Clearly.
You got that chrome brain, dude.
Let me just buy guitar. There we go.
There you
Note
go.
Made.
It's great. I'll do the same, Jake.
Okay. But you have it, set it now.
Yeah.
And then have like your Google Calendar notify you.
Scheduled for my birthday in 3 years.
Jake, you should get one of those guitar kits where you make your own guitar and you should make a vlog about it. I'm just saying.
I
know you got a lot of free time.
Yeah, that sounds really tough to do.
You just follow the instructions.
It's a fine art making a good guitar. It's craftsmanship.
Nick didn't say it was going to be good.
Yeah, no one said that.
Oh, it's not going to be good. But it'll be yours.
I'd rather just, you know how cheap you can get like a decent guitar these days? It's pretty amazing.
Go to a secondhand store, man. Secondhand music store.
Well, that too. I mean, the old one was a Yamaha that I got for like $100. And, you know, with a nice pair of strings on there, it actually sounded like pretty good. There's a noticeable difference when you play like a real guitar, but marginal.
Some of the best guitars I ever played are like old warped guitars with super high actions, and you can barely press the strings down, but they sound amazing.
That sounds because like janky,
the wood in a guitar, it actually resonates better the older it is. It's like you know, a brand new guitar isn't going to sound as nice, especially in classical guitars, like. Mm. Finally, my Yamaha, my starter student classical, has mellowed out, and it's like the best sounding guitar now. It's
That's
like,
crazy.
And it's like been 12 years. So
I wonder if you can put them in like a wine cellar, and it'll you
soak
know,
it in wine for 12
it'll
years.
It'll age faster.
I mean, aren't the best violins in the world the Stradivarius violins that were made in like the 1500s or whatever,
dude?
And like people still use them and play with them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh my god, that's too much for me, dude. I couldn't handle that kind of pressure.
Look, if you're like the best violinist in the world, go for it. Like, isn't that cool to like have this artifact and still like have it
That's amazing. Music. That's so cool. That's like the most cool.
Dude, I got to go to the Met over the weekend when I was in New York, and they have a whole exhibit. This whole room in their permanent collection.
Wait, did you go to the Met Gala with all the loser celebrities?
No, I was there before all the loser celebrities.
You were like all black, like the
Yeah, I wore a garbage bag, and I was very
fashionable. Can I just say something about the Met Gala?
Oh, yeah. Please. Oh, no. We'd love to hear your hot take on the Met Gala.
It's pretty hot. Here's my hot take on the Met Gala. Fuck those people.
Yeah.
Fuck those people. Anyways, let's move on. Nick, you were at the Met Gala.
Oh, no, I mean, there were a bunch of Stradivariuses in case. There was the first piano.
Oh, yeah,
I saw the picture. Sorry, not the first piano. The oldest piano that is in existence still is there. And it's like one of the first pianos made by the inventor of the piano. And there's no glass case around it. There's just this sign that says, please do not touch. And right there.
They're just asking. Wow.
They're just asking for someone to freaking play that key. And I wanted to so badly. But I didn't want to get kicked out because I still wanted to see all the swords.
Maybe all the strings are wired up with like vibration sensors. Yeah. So something
maybe
like
that's what they should do. They should put up a sign that says, please don't touch. If you do, you will not be able to see the swords.
All sword privileges revoked. They were like almost baiting someone to touch this thing because they also right below it have this freaking video monitor with this guy just going ham on this piano. And it sounds great. And he's just having a great old time. He's like, this is great. You should try it, but don't touch. You're like, dang it. I want to try it.
I like the idea of being so good at piano that you look at that piano and you're like, I could give this a shot, and if I play this song well enough, people won't get mad at me.
I can see the swords.
It's very daring.
That's bold. Cool. Yeah. You'd have to really be good, though. We don't want no scrubs. Mm-mm. You know, no. if you're gonna touch that piano, you better do it. You better do it justice for the.
It might be the last song that ever comes out of it. So, you know, you gotta represent all of humanity's musical ambitions.
Oh God! Song. Oh, so much pressure.
Why do humans like music, Jake?
You know, I was thinking about this the other day because I've got a 1-year-old daughter and she was listening to a song and she was dancing.
That's adorable.
And it's like, it's not like she knows. It's not like she.
Yeah.
It's not like she's like, oh, yeah, people dance and dancing's cool. So I'm going to dance, too.
Yeah.
You know, like she just hears it and she starts dancing.
It's like an innate behavior that humans have to move their bodies to a rhythm, right?
Well, I think it's not that much different than like, you know, an actual physical form of interacting with something because it creates a physical sound wave. Mm-hmm. The physical sound wave happens in a pattern that your brain recognizes as like harmonious or consistent, you know. It's got a mathematical pattern to it. And then I think, you know, it's almost like, yeah, it's like a physical response that I think goes deeper than, I mean, animals dance, you know, monkeys dance, like there's all kinds of birds do little dances to each other all the time and clicks and like make little, I think it's just something that goes deeper than humanity for sure.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, you have, like, you know, beating hearts, and you have, like, the rhythm of walking, like, left, right, and you have, you know, you have melodic inflections in how we speak to each other, so.
But, like, imagine when you're in water, you know? Like, when you're in water, you immediately do this.
Mm-hmm. Stick your arms up.
Yeah, you start, you know, I don't know if that's learned or if that's natural, but, like, you immediately try to swim, and babies will do this, too. If you put a baby in water, they'll immediately try to swim. I think it's kind of the same. Like if you hear music and you are immediately like trying to connect with it and like understand the beat. And like once you know, if you have it and it makes sense to you, then all of a sudden you start bobbing your head and tapping your feet.
It's just strange how we can pair music so well with emotional tones.
Yes.
Like, oh yeah. You know, it's weird that those two pair. Like, you know, I can see like, oh, we enjoy music, we enjoy rhythms, you know, like it triggers the things that, you know, in our brain that are wired up to make us walk or, you know, appreciate heartbeats or, you know, like all those other instinctual things. But then it's like, oh, and we can also define various emotional tones with it. And that's like, oh, that's weird.
I don't know if that's natural or if that's learned.
I was about to say that's probably a learned thing because you have to connect them. You have to connect like certain types of music to emotions, right? So.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder.
You're listening. You, in like another dimension, there's like kids' videos. Are those gas pipe sounds that they use in horror movies?
That's what we learned that represents like innocent happiness. Yeah. Which is like, yeah.
Really sentimental moment in like a cinematic movie. It's like hard rock or fucking metal. It's
just the highest note on guitar just being plucked as fast as it can be. Like, I'm gonna cry. It's so touching.
Give me that xylophone to represent my inner darkness, dude.
Yeah,
really brooding.
The happy like Caribbean xylophone,
dude. So emo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's probably another dimension where that's going on right now.
One would hope, at least.
Maybe a podcast similar to this.
Yeah.
And they start off that podcast with a very interesting song.
Yep. Everyone just screams at the top of their lungs.
And then they talk about it for 12 minutes before they actually get into the topic of what this podcast is about.
This is the topic. Music is the most important thing in humanity.
All right. Seriously, let's get on track, gentlemen. Okay. You guys went out and shot a video yesterday. What happened? What the hell happened out there?
Oh, man. Well, I barely made it out alive. It was crazy.
Yeah.
No, I'm kidding.
Nico, this came up quick because when we discussed this topic originally, it was kind of chill. You know, Christian and I were talking about this today, and it was like, hey, we'll have a couple sword fighters come into the studio and, you know, we'll just film like a cool, like, you know, what would a fight scene actually look like type.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, Christian was sending me memes last Friday about how things escalated quickly.
Yeah.
Well, if you guys don't know by now you know how I operate when it comes to sword fights.
That's actually been the last two lightsaber style videos. It's
like the same thing. All the videos I make are lightsaber videos now. Yeah. Even though I said I'd never go back to them when I was like 10 years old.
Hey, I make lightsaber videos.
I make lightsaber videos on YouTube.
We're lightsaber people now.
We do all these stuntman react videos where we critique stunts and we talk about, you know, not necessarily ragging on them for not being real, because, you know, there's a difference between like movie reality and reality. But we've talked about, wouldn't it be cool if somebody took the time to portray something like a sword fight using authentic choreography and authentic sword strategy, and it wasn't just purely acrobatics and like baton swinging. I've done some, you know, studies of the blade.
studies of the blade.
And so that's something that, you know, I'm like, oh, it'd be cool to see. I would enjoy doing that. And we happen to have a pretty solid, you know, network of people around us that are very talented at those kind of things as well. So we decided, you know, let's take a look at lightsabers. Let's take it beyond the sword, and not just lightsabers, but energy swords in general. And like, what would an imaginary weapon like that look like if we applied that realism treatment? Because really, you can go on YouTube and you can watch realistic sword fights. You know, there's a lot of sparring, there's a lot of martial arts up there, but there's not a lot of like, hey, let's take these people who are very smart and talented and then have them focus all their efforts on something completely imaginary and then just make it up. That's what we did with these lightsabers. And, you know, it was interesting seeing the choreography come together, because it's something that's fresh and it's new. You know, it's not like Jedi fighting like you see in Star Wars. It's, you know, like, what, there's so many different thoughts that have to go into moves when you actually need to make them strategic and sensible. But a byproduct of that is that moves carry more emotion and intention, which is like, those are like the key things behind like acting and characters. You know, you need to know what they want. They need to be actively trying to do that. And the moment in a sword fight that you start like twirling your sword around and spinning around, the character no longer apparently wants to kill the other person. And apparently they'd rather dance. But, you know, whatever, it's instinctual, right? All that screeching in the background, you just can't help yourself in that alternate dimension. Yeah.
So what are like the key differences between like a Star Wars branded lightsaber duel?
Well, one key difference is when you swing a sword. Well, so Luke LaFontaine helped us choreograph this, and he's really good at these kind of things. And he also has a very deep knowledge base and will just share it with you until you're like,
unsolicitedly.
He cares a lot.
It's great. I love it. It makes it really easy to film court or crew videos with him.
For sure.
Because you will always get what you need from him.
Luke LaFontaine once said to me, Jake, you know what? Can you imagine where I'd be if I had your face? Come on.
Yeah.
National treasure.
He's pretty great. So he choreographed the sword fight, and, you know, he's talking about, you know, in real sword fights, there's really just two things you got to be good at. It's distance and time. You have to be at the right distance at the right time. And as long as you are out of distance, the other person can swing the sword however they want. They'll never hit you. And, you know, you literally have up to like a quarter of an inch that you can get into. And if you're good enough, that's how you can position yourself. But likewise, if you want to step into range and hit somebody else, you are putting yourself in danger. So you have to time it just perfectly for the amount of time that you are in distance where they can strike you and where you can strike them. They do not have the time to be able to hit you, and you have the time to be able to hit them. Oddly enough, this all applies to Smash Brothers as well.
Frame perfect.
Wow. But it's one of those things that you'll watch for, you know, like an opponent's sword. You know, if they're going to go for a strike, you know, they lift it up and they start to bring it in for a strike. You know, so there's a certain amount of time it takes the sword to travel. They lift the sword too far out of center. Now it has to travel that entire distance to get to you. And if your sword is in center or in a, you know, closer position to hit them, well, as long as you move fast enough and your distance is good, it'll take you less time to hit them and you'll get the strike. And in a lot of sword fights, you're just going for wrists. You're not going for like body strikes. You're not going for decapitations or giant, you know, cleaves. You're just going for the wrists. And if you can hit the wrists, you win. And so that's one of the things that was, I was going to say programmed, but that's one of the things that was choreographed into the sword fight, was very conscious wrist strikes and distance maneuvers and an attempt to just control the center with your sword and then go for the other opponent's arms, which is not big and flashy, but if you can see it clearly and it can kind of be highlighted, suddenly, you know, once again, it's, oh, all they need to do is hit the other character's wrist. Look how close this is. Look how close this is to life and death. Look how close this is to one winning and one losing. And so that was like, that's something that's interesting to see come out of it. Another thing is, you know, when making an attack, you need to be also defensively attacking, so to speak. So if your attack does not land or you miss, you can't then just leave yourself open for a counterattack. You know, your sword needs to land controlled in the center, you know, keeping the opponent at range or boxing out their blade wherever it might be. And once again, this can really limit the amount of acrobatics and spinning you can do with a blade. But as long as you can communicate that intention of these swords are deadly and these swords are dangerous, you are in a good position. You know, one of the things that, like, a lot of this applies to gunfights, too. And this is one of the things that, like, Sam and I talked a lot about when we were working on Lifeline, because there's a couple gunfights in that. And, you know, we do all different types of gunfights, right? There's tactical reloads where really guns might as well be shooting, you know, thank you cards for all the, for all the damage they do. But then you have, you know, more serious stuff. And when we were, like, working on Lifeline, we talked about how, you know, we try to communicate this to the actors and the rest of the crew on set, is that whenever the trigger of a gun is pulled in real life, you know, if you're not at the shooting range, but if you're actually, like, you know, in a fight, it's with the intent of killing somebody. Every time that trigger is pulled, you don't just go blah, blah, blah casually. It's, you know, each one of those moments has a lot of weight behind it. And if you just write a script where, like, the character shoots a couple times, he runs down the hall and he shoots a couple more times, and they shoot back and they duck and they shoot some more. Like, you're making each one of those life and death decisions just a flippant, like, whatever. You know, I'll just shoot some bullets down the hallway. You know, I'm going to take cover. Whoa, shoot some more bullets over the thing. It's like, no, like, each one of those could kill a person. And not just the person you're shooting at, but somebody else behind the wall that, you know, the bullet's going to go through. And, you know, trying to portray a gunfight with that weight is tricky, but can be rewarding. And then the sword fight is very similar, where every swing is an intent to kill. And also putting your life on the line even more so, because in sword fights, you have to put yourself in range to land that swing. So every single moment you step into there, your adrenaline is spiked and your heartbeat's beating faster. And, you know, the very inches of where your feet land and how much footwork you have, like, all of that stuff matters 100%. Anyways, this is a long.
So how do you film? So how do you frame how that? Do you film that? How do you frame that, though?
You chill out and you back up. You don't get in there and do the Jason Bourne, you know, shaky.
You don't do Jason Bourne it.
No. And, you know, okay. Like, For as easy of a target as Jason Bourne is, it's really just like a couple fight scenes in one of the Bourne movies. Like, a lot of the other Bourne fight scenes are shaky cam, but they're actually super fun and really well shot, and you can actually follow them. It's just they are done in a way to be chaotic and to be thrilling, but I think they actually, a lot of them do succeed in doing that. But in this case, you know, like in a Jason Bourne fight, you're not necessarily there to see the technique. At the end of the day, they're throwing punches and doing some judo grapples, and you've probably seen that fight about 10 times before as happened in Jason Bourne. So, you know, when the fight happens in Jason Bourne, the choreography itself, while good and fun, is not necessarily worth highlighting over the characters and the cinematography and the emotion of the scenes. Like, all this stuff is probably more important than, like, well, check out this cool way he blocks a punch. Pretty neat, huh? Like, there's not a whole lot of that in those movies. But when you get into a fight where you're trying to be very realistic with the fight, then you do need to do that. You need to show, wow, check out this cool way they block the punch. Check out this cool way he goes for an attack and almost gets cut, but has a clever way out of it. Like, all those little moves and decisions are a lot more important. And if you do the shaky cam thing and you get in there, you're not going to see any of that. So when we shot this fight scene, we also approached it with a very different, like, cinematic approach of, you know, we do a lot of handheld fight scenes on Corridor, but in this case, it was very smooth, very, like, stabilized, cinematic. Like, we kept referencing, like, Dune and, like, Blade Runner 2049 as our, I guess just Roger Deakins as our, yeah, we just referenced Roger Deakins for all of cinematography.
It was easy.
But specifically, it was so we could, you know, make pretty wide angles and have nicely framed side shots, show all the swords. And honestly, you know, Luke was watching all this, and he's, you know, does design and choreography and coordination and all that kind of stuff. So he comes up with cool angles too for, like, his job, but he's just saying, like, just back it up and make sure you get it all in frame. Just back it up, make sure you get it all in frame. That's a great shot. You didn't quite get it all in frame. Make sure you just back up and get it all in frame. And, like, that was his only notes, like, for the entire day, was just back it up, get it all in frame. And I mean, I'd play the line, you know, I want to be just close enough that it's exciting still. But yeah, that was it does take a lot of the work off of your shoulders when the stuntmen are good and the choreography is good and tells a story, which it did in this case. You're just, at that point, you're filming a dance. Back it up. Keep it all in the frame.
Yeah. And I just saw an edit that Nico made till 1 a.m. last night.
Yeah, so we shot for 10 hours, and I started importing the footage, and I got home, ate dinner. I was like, oh, I really want to see the footage. And I sat down, like, this is cool. I should cut a few shots together. And then, like, it was 1 a.m. I'm like, okay, I need to go to bed.
Yeah. Ivy walks in, and you're, like, itching your neck, going, just one more.
Yeah. Just one more. Yeah, pretty
just,
much.
Just one more.
I paid for it a little bit this morning. That and, you know, holding a camera in my hands for 10 hours straight yesterday, so.
Yeah.
Okay, that's it. I've done it. As promised, over the last few weeks, I've spent my entire life just reading through all these books, looking for any hint, any word, any paragraph that could tell people where they can go for all of their stock asset needs, for creators and businesses alike. Turns out, I've read through all these books, and there's nothing. And that's why, courtesy of today's sponsor, Storyblocks, I'm just so thankful that there is a place where people can go to get stock assets. I'm just over the moon about it. So here's the deal. You can go to Storyblocks and you can get high quality 4K B-roll. You can get images, you can get music, you can get After Effects templates, motion graphics, and more. And they have a virtually unlimited library that they're constantly updating. So every time you go on there, nothing is the same. Unlike these books, every time I go to page 52 in this book, turns out, same words on there, same images. Get out of here. You know what I'm saying? Thank God there is a place where people can go to get royalty-free stock assets to use in whatever they want, however they want, through an unlimited all-access plan. Thank God Storyblocks has that available just for you. And hey, if you're part of a creative team, consider talking to your team lead about an enterprise plan. That's going to allow you and the rest of your team to get all the benefits of Storyblocks. It's something we use here at Corridor Digital. It helps us out a lot. It improves, smooths out, and enhances our production process, saves us a bunch of time, saves us a bunch of money. And I gotta say, it's real good that it does that, because the amount of time it took me to read through all these books, man, probably a huge waste of money for me to do that. So anyways, if you guys are interested in getting started with Storyblocks for yourself, consider clicking the link in the description below or heading over to storyblocks.com/corridorcast. And next time, here's what I'm going to do. I found a bunch of old VHS tapes, okay, in my studio. I'm going to watch through all of them, okay? I will let you know in another week or two if there's anything on these VHS tapes that can tell you where to go for all of your stock asset needs. In the meantime, have fun. Enjoy Storyblocks. And now back to the podcast.
Yeah.
It seemed like in the edit, like, and this is definitely true from when we were shooting it in the coverage, it was a lot of wide, a lot of like showing the action. And then when we do cut in for the close-ups, that's for the emotional moments.
Yep.
You know, that's not showing the action necessarily or the technique. It's about like the emotional beats and how that impacts the story.
So. Yeah. Which is like, it can be almost like so vanilla in a sense that you can almost feel like you should be discouraged from doing that as a filmmaker. It's like, oh, show the fight center wide, then cut to a close up to show the emotions. It's like that's like baby's first editing techniques. Mm-hmm. But then again,
yeah,
you know,
but third technique is you make one of them a Dutch angle.
Yeah, but like also like, you know, if you look at like a dialogue scene in a really good movie, there's still it's baby's first dialogue scene. It's, you know, over the shoulder telephoto shot with the person lit nicely from one side and an edge light. It's like they're not reinventing the wheel. It's the dialogue and the acting that really is what you're trying to showcase. And same thing with the sword fight. You know, like you're saying that, like you pull it back and you simplify the cinematography because really you're just there to showcase the actors doing their thing and doing their performance. And the writing in this case is physical body language.
Yeah. Yeah. And in this case, I don't think it is like baby's first, you know, editing techniques and storytelling techniques because it's people don't do it as much.
That's
true.
It's grandpa's first.
It's grandpa's. Thank you.
Yeah.
First
grandpa's learned, but
fine,
he keeps doing it.
Fine crafted.
Yeah.
Grandpa's finely crafted editing techniques.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was a good time. I think we should talk briefly about how cool the lightsabers are.
I want to hear about this facility too. Yeah. I want to hear about the facility. I want to hear about Brett.
He's the star of the show.
And yeah. was Brett like the wise old man?
So Brett was, I should look up the definition of this real quick. Brett was like on the script, he's referred to as the technician, but I don't, that's not quite what he actually is. He is a, hold on. I got to define.
Who played the sage?
We don't know yet.
Brett was the proctor. He was the proctor. So there's the proctor. Story of this short film, this cinematic short masterpiece. This short sword fight is that it's not Star Wars. It's just generic future. This is a sword fighting school where they learn how to fight with energy blades. Because I want to stay away from like Jedi stuff, right? I don't want the Force to get involved in this. The fight scene's not going to look like a Star Wars fight scene, so let's not make it Star Wars. So this is a sword fighting school that produces the best students in the world. And they have a certain method of doing that. And that is, in order to graduate, the student must fight their teacher in a duel to the death. Because it's one thing to have training. It's another thing to actually have to deal with your adrenaline, your nerves, and getting into a situation that's actually life or death, which if you got into a real sword fight, that's what it more or less would be. So they get into a sword fight, and Brett is the proctor watching all this happen. Meanwhile, on the edge of the scene, there's a janitor who's kind of like, you know, just taking out the garbage and mopping the floors, and they just stop and they watch because this is fascinating. This old man like steps up next to them and starts explaining kind of what's happening. You know, this is a graduation day. Basically gives them the setup that I just gave you here. And also kind of breaks down the fight a little bit and what the fighters are thinking. And this is kind of my way of just getting to show the audience and highlight some of the things that are happening in the fight in a way that's in the world of this piece. But needless to say, halfway through, the student gets his butt kicked and gets killed because his teacher is better than him. You know, and the student has some flaws in his technique. But because it's the future, Brett Driver here, the son, the proctor, walks off and pulls out this giant machine and brings it back around and uses it to reattach the limbs and seal up the holes on this dead student
and
bring it back to
life. The son of life, son. The son of life.
That's right. Because the reason this school is the best school for sword fighters in the world is because they can actually do fights to the death and then revive the students so they can keep going and learn from their mistakes. So that when they go out in that world and they don't have access to the giant machines because they're not in the school's facilities anymore, they at least have, you know, a handle on their nerves and have figured out, you know, they can control their adrenaline and their mental state and all that kind of stuff. So we watch as the fight goes through a few more iterations of the student trying different techniques. And we actually hit on some tropes of different sword fights. Like he does the Star Wars, you know, flip-de-doo, whoop-de-doo stuff and gets killed. He does like the super emotional big hits that you see in like, you know, John Wick, he gets killed. He does, you know, another style of movie sword fighting, and then just the sword gets twisted out of his arms and then just literally chops off both his hands in like a helicopter motion. And then eventually, you know, the student learns from his mistakes. He centers himself, learns to control both his technique, his headspace, all that kind of stuff. And of course, I won't spoil the ending, but
don't spoil
what happens.
Hey, so what happens if they like can't bring you back though, you know?
Well, then you die.
And they're
you're still nervous going into this.
Do you sign that waiver when you accept like that?
Those things are finicky.
Yeah,
sometimes.
The student's not gonna make it.
2% failure rate, and you got to sign a waiver because last semester Timmy didn't come back.
Exactly. It's high stakes. This is high stakes high school.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's the general premise for this, but it's fun to be able to, because that's the other thing, is like in a real sword fight, once again, they don't last that long. So it's like, you know, pop, 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 pop. Then I got cut. It's over. So this is a way for us to be able to do that and then be able to get back into the fight. Just, you know, it's cool VFX, like, you know, arm reattaches and the kid gets back up and back into the fight and you go for it. So, yeah.
So, okay. So did you shoot everything yesterday or is there another scene?
We didn't shoot the dialogue stuff yesterday. Okay. So we just shot the fight scene. Okay. We did shoot at this really cool warehouse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was awesome.
Christian, how did you find this place? Scrounging
along.
So we use PeerSpace a lot for our location hunting, and locations in Los Angeles are expensive. You're probably looking at a minimum of like $3,000 just to get an open space. And then if you want to like look nice, it's like another $1,000. And that's a lot of money, especially for a day of shooting. Yeah. You know, obviously like there's big productions that have the budget, so you're kind of, you don't really have anybody going like, oh man, fine, I'll cut you a deal, because they can just not cut you a deal and have a big budget thing come in instead.
Dude, when we filmed Sync back in the day, we made a budget and we were like, yeah, $20,000 for locations. That should be that should be plenty.
Yeah, was it?
No, son. No.
Locations were cheaper back then, though. I remember.
Well, there was a few that we pretty much blew through that in like 2 days of filming on.
Yeah.
There was that medical facility in Santa Clarita.
That was $5,000. I remember that.
And then there was that bank vault where they filmed The Dark Knight. Yeah. And then there was that futuristic office in Skid Row.
Literally in the middle of Skid Row.
Yeah. Anyways.
Yeah. And all the rest of it was like backyards of our friend's place and like gorilla stuff on the street.
Richard Ryan's apartment.
Richard Ryan's apartment. Yep. I remember that. He was really chill of him to let us shoot in his apartment.
Well, it helped that he was the building manager.
Yeah, it did help.
Yeah. Yeah. That way no one could kick us out.
Yeah, except for the landlord.
Landlord. Yeah, the landlord and the permit police. Permit PD.
Permit PD.
It was really funny yesterday morning when I walked on to the location. I talked to the manager on location, and she asked us if we wanted to back in our trucks and our Sprinter vans. And I was like, ha, we have a Kia Soul.
We do.
We got some cars, just our cars.
I mean, I have two sandbags in that Kia Soul.
Think of how legit it would be, though, guys, if we backed in a Sprinter van. Think of how legit that would be.
It'd be pretty legit.
It would be pretty legit. Nico, this marks. I'm marking this one down on the.
We should have bought that bus, Jake.
Was this podcast just a ruse for us to have a Sprinter van meeting now?
Yeah, he planned
it. It's all
that.
On the record now. Yeah. Hold on. He's saying okay here.
Jake,
I was reading.
We said we weren't going to present him with the PowerPoint yet.
Sprinter van 9/15/2021.
Dude, we can use the van for other things than just carrying gear, though, Nico. We can have it be like an office.
Lightsaber.
Trust me, you're gonna love it.
Yeah, you're gonna love it.
We can
do stakeouts with it too.
Stakeouts.
Right?
Yeah.
Stakeouts.
Totally.
Hell yeah.
Stakeouts. Well, actually, you guys now, I might be convinced. Like, now are we talking? Are we talking stakeouts where you're sitting in the driver's seat and your seat's leaned back just a little bit?
Exactly.
Or is it stakeouts where there's like a little hole in like the side of the van?
You can
or
do
is
both.
That where the tech sits with his headphones?
No, there's a technician table in the back. And then there's one guy in the front who like is just the driver, but he sits there, you know, and he's like, hey boss, you know, and then and then it's like, and then boss is in the back with the technician, and then technician pulls up the exterior cameras,
right?
Oh, and just an unnecessary amount of screens
Totally
as
way
many
too
as possible.
Everywhere.
Yeah, you should always put people's lav mics on in the Sprinter van like we're giving them a wire and then send them to the set and, like,
and then it
no
says
finds
like
out.
It says like Billy's typewriter repair on the outside. Billy's mobile typewriter repair.
Yeah.
Dude. For when it doesn't
hallway remodeling.
And their phrase is like for when it just doesn't click.
He's warming up to
dude,
it.
You're prepped, man. Where did that come from? Is this actually part of the
do you see what we're doing?
You guys planned this, didn't you?
I've been ready for this, you know, forever.
How much we've got multiple design options. Okay, we've got Billy's typewriter.
Oh, get the leather seats. Get the leather seats.
We have the Dueling Wizard design. It's going to be a little bit more expensive for the Dueling Wizards, but you know, I think if we can get Sam on board, then it's good.
Yeah. How can you elevate it though? It's like I've seen Dueling Wizards. How do you get some spice?
Like some more spice than airbrushed Dueling Wizards?
Yeah.
Well, we do, candy paint, you know, like candy sparkle paint. Sparkle paint. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then maybe instead of a sliding door, it's got suicide doors.
Oh.
So you know? Have gull wings?
Yeah, the gull wings.
No. Suicide doors open. Gold.
Right.
Not the ones that open like that. Not the X-wings. The suicide doors that open backwards.
Right.
Ooh, so you can open.
Why are
like
they called suicide stores? Doors. Suicide stores.
Suicide stores.
I think because you're more likely to die with those doors. But I don't know why that would be suicide.
Accidental death doors.
Pretty sure if you jump out of a moving car, you're gonna die.
That would be more cool like, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, it wouldn't even be homicide at that point because that's killing of a human being by a human being. I don't Robocide. Know why they
Darwin
call them
doors.
Doricide.
Darwinian doors.
I don't
anyway,
know. Anyway,
because it's cool, Nico. That's why.
How much is a Sprinter van, Jake?
I mean, how many miles does it have?
Let's say 100K miles.
100K. Oh, God. How old is it?
It doesn't need to be nice. I mean, it can
How
it
old
up.
Is it? How old is it?
I don't know. It's probably 4 years old. Three or four.
4 years old and it's got 100,000 miles. So it's driven a lot. Probably 13,000, 14,000.
Not in this market.
It's probably more now. Yeah, it's probably more now.
It's probably like 18 at that.
Well, by the time this podcast goes live, it'll probably be like 19.
Jesus.
I had to buy a new car. And it's $10,000 more than they're actually worth. It sucks, but you got to do what you got to do, you know?
So even the new car market is super inflated.
Yeah. Wow. It's not as bad, which is why I went new, but still.
Oh, man.
Yeah, it's still rough. Yeah.
Well, you know, you dump 5.6 T into the economy and it has a tendency to do strange things. That's about how much we spent on the global war on terror when you don't count the medical bills after the fact. But anyways, I digress. Sprinter vans have gotten expensive and the candy paint job is really what this all comes down to.
That's going to add value, though. So,
it's going to add value. Think about it. Yeah. And we can film with it. And the problem is that it doesn't make, if you go that route, you don't have a very good stakeout van because now it's like super noticeable, you know? So there's a problem with that.
Yeah.
But maybe you take it to high end like events and now you have a stakeout van at the high end event because they wouldn't let in Billy's typewriter repair.
Exactly.
What are
now
you
they're like,
out,
hey, let
though?
In.
That's how we get in the Met Gala next year.
That's how we get in the Met Gala. Yes.
It can be like an exterminator van and we'll all dress as bugs.
Yes. And we'll stake out the Met
Gala. We should
wear
those inflatable bubbles to the Met Gala next year and just roll down the stairs.
I don't know what you're referring to, but
remember those inflatable bubbles that we ran over Carmichael?
Oh, those. Okay. Yeah.
We'll roll over.
We'll wear just those. Just
I got the facts on suicide doors, by the way.
Okay.
Please. Yeah. All right. That's what we've all been waiting for.
All right. So this is from the website. I have a feeling that they're bullshitting me. And they actually have no idea, but I'm going to tell you what they said.
From the website.
The little part of my brain that goes, they're making it up, is, triggering here. So you said rear hinge doors, these suicide doors. By the way, the suicide doors started from the day of carriage design, where they wanted the doors of the carriage to open like nice doors to a house, like a French mansion. Mm-hmm. So apparently, back in the day before seatbelts, the wind would blow your doors open and you'd go flying out the car. And the Subaru in 1969 had this problem. Also, if you are opening the door and it gets hit by a car, like say you're stepping out of the street, the door closes back on you, killing you, as opposed to getting knocked open away from you.
Oh, my God.
And that's about all I could find. I guess, you know, I think this website was... Like, they had some really, like, flimsy arguments beyond that that felt like they didn't do any
research.
Did
someone, like, kill themselves, like, on purpose in the
I
door?
Think
like,
it's because of the opening thing. I think it's because of the opening thing, the way that they open. Like, you can fall out. I think that's what it... So if you sit...
Suicidal.
...with a suicide door, you're suicidal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well... That's good to know. I'll put that one in my pocket for later.
Yeah. And I don't know if they've done them. Oh, I guess they do them on the Phantoms. But after the Lincoln Continental, after the mid-60s Lincoln Continental, they kind of got rid of them.
Yeah. I think also they mentioned that people have a tendency to like bonk people when they open the doors because they're not looking behind the car. But they're like, it's probably not an issue because the chauffeur is usually opening it for you.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
The carriage master.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hey, is that where car comes from? I've debated this for years.
Carriage?
Yeah. Does it come from carriage?
Oh,
car?
I never thought about that. That's like probably
that's a
true.
Good question. Well, I have the internet here on my phone. So
okay.
Yeah.
Can you look this up?
Does.
Welcome it's to the corner cast, guys. For the rest of the night, we're just going to look up random things.
Google shit.
Do you get Wi-Fi in that thing?
Yeah. I know.
Car comes from Latin. Carum, carus. Old Northern French. Carre, which goes to car. Wheeled vehicle. So carriage, yeah. They come from the same root.
Hmm. Okay.
So car, carum, carus, etc. I guess it's always been a car. Since before the before the internal combustion.
Since before the car, it was a car.
What about cab? How does cab, like caboose and cab? Is that just a place where passengers go?
Cabby.
Good question.
Cabin.
Oh, also, didn't you say there's no, Nick, isn't there no hard C in Latin? Isn't it sar?
That is no. I think it's there's no hard or soft S. I'm pretty sure. Like
that's Caesar. Or, Caesar. Oh wait, you're right.
Caesar was more like Kaiser is how they.
Oh wait, Kaiser yeah.
is how they'd pronounce it.
There's another old car word, chariot.
Mm-hmm. Oh, chariot.
That's probably the first one. Yeah.
Wait, so S's are pronounced like Z's or. What is it?
I guess they're actually pronounced like K's.
If anyone listening is a Latin expert right now, please let us know.
Sorry.
apologize.
Yeah, we were sorry.
For this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. Latin's crazy. Watch Barbarians. You'll hear some real.
No pronouns. How do they do it? How do they do it? They don't have pronouns.
How does that work? We should invent something.
How do you go from not having pronouns to having pronouns? How does that work?
Slang, probably.
Honestly. It's got like, yeah. How else does it work? Because
it just became easier to say.
They didn't have pronouns because of the way you conjugated the verb, which is still the same in Latin dialect languages.
I'm sure another language melded with it to get there.
Maybe.
By the way, did any of you guys look at the new iPhone 13 stuff?
Mm-mm. I saw like a cinematic reel, which is freaking sweet.
Yeah, so when the iPhone 12 came out, I remember talking, maybe even on this podcast, when it was a Futurology podcast, which is just becoming a Futurology podcast again right now.
welcome back.
Welcome back. So I talked about how with like the Z-Depth and the LiDAR on the iPhone, I feel like Apple is on their way to making large format sensors. Not necessarily obsolete, but way more specialty. Because they're basically getting it to where it doesn't matter how big your sensor is. You can do all your depth of field after the fact as long as you have good like Z depth. Mm-hmm. And if you have a LiDAR scanning the scene and then you probably give a little bit of AI sauce on top so it can kind of fill in the details, you know, you're probably looking at, you know, the ability to actually judge distance on all the pixels and then blur them appropriately. So that's what they did.
They're doing that. Now, they're doing that post now.
They're doing that post in the iPhone 13, and it has the ability to do focus pulling basically after the fact because it's saving a Z depth map of the scene. When I say Z depth, I mean a depth mat, and then that's combined with some AI stuff that does portrait mode on the phone. But now I can do it in video in real time, and they have ProRes even.
Oh, really?
Which this is all really cool, and you know, hey, good job, Apple engineers, but maybe don't have a Lightning port
on
the bottom of your
phone,
which
is
still
USB-C. Wait a minute.
USB 2.0 speeds.
Dude, there's nothing worse than trying to get a video file off of your iPhone.
It's the worst.
Dude,
it's the absolute worst.
It opens up 8 folders. They're all named random numbers. And then your photos are randomly mixed in all the photos.
It's just everywhere.
It's like, there's no rhyme or reason.
And half
there's
the time
no...
it doesn't mount either.
It's like, what the frick?
It's like, you guys can't get that. You guys can't, like, it is like a purposely, like, fuck you from Apple. Like, don't open the phone. Don't get your files. We're going to try to make it hard. That's one of the things I hate about, like, modern, dude. I guess, like, devices and games is like there's a lot of like we know you want this but also fuck you a little bit here. It's like, can you just give me the thing without the fuck you?
Yeah.
And it's like no.
No, Nico. Like, how is their stock gonna be worth $2 billion? Dude.
Ugh. Man, they like making 30% on basically every transaction on the internet is how they get away with it. Yeah. You know, I'm glad Epic took him to court, and I'm sad to see people like.
Oh, sorry. Did I say I meant 2 trill.
Yeah.
2.4 trill. Hey, you know what? Come to think of it, I think the American government kind of needs that money. Maybe they should liquidate it.
Jake, have you been listening to a lot of talk radio?
No. But okay. Back in the day, there was a camera called the LG V10 that had manual focus pulling on it. And I'm trying to see. Yeah. And I'm trying to see if it was a post process or if it was an actual camera.
It was.
Lens.
It has to have been an actual. There's no way it was a post process. If it was like older than 1 year, it's like there's no way it was post. Unless there's a light field camera, which I doubt. But
now with all the iPhones like leading up to this one, the depth of field, the fake depth of field has been like kind of rough because any fine detail like hair, it doesn't really work. Mm-hmm. So did you see if that like?
It looked like it's a little bit better, but it looks like it's definitely.
Yeah.
It's that edge on the character's head is a little weird.
Yeah, you know? It's pretty clear. You can clearly tell it's a post-process thing still. So.
It's got a little bit of, like that video game field look.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not quite there yet, but.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool I almost tech. Bought one of the V10s because it had that feature. And I think it came out like 5 years ago. Yeah, about 5 years ago. Manual focus, it's saying. That was kind of one of the first ones that had like, wait, what? You could pull focus on your camera on your
it's
phone
like
with your fingies. You don't need fingies. A lens. Yeah,
camera tech is definitely like going crazy places. Like we're definitely at the point right now where it's like you have zero excuses for your stuff not to look cinematic outside of just you have not yet gained the knowledge on how to make things look cinematic. Like beyond, like technically speaking, like. You can't blame it on your gear anymore. It's like literally all the gear is good. And it's not only good, it's like paradigm shifting good.
Yeah.
You know, man. Yeah, it's pretty crazy. I feel like to be a really good cinematographer these days, I feel like you need to really have your head wrapped around color grading and lighting more than like anything else. And cinematic language, like when to, you know, do different moves and framings and stuff like that.
Dude. Yeah. And not rely on gimbals for everything. I know we just shot a gimbal movie.
Yeah.
But that's a different thing. But dude, nothing pisses me off when a guy just shoots everything on a gimbal.
Yeah.
He keeps it locked off and tries to be a tripod, but he's not. And you see this little sway side to side. You're like, dude, that's Jenkins.
Yeah. Like, it's not a tripod.
It's not a tripod. It's so lazy.
Did this happen in your edit, Nick? In your movie edit?
Yes. No.
This sounds
awesome,
way too personal. For you to
well, we didn't have time to like switch on and off of the gimbal, so like we had to shoot a lot of things just kind of rushed on a gimbal.
Yeah,
the gimbal look is so specific too. Yeah. You can always tell with that like X and Y. You
yeah,
know,
exactly. I'm happy we did for the movement just, shots, but like some of the shots that are like the locked off shots are just like not usable.
Can you fix any of it with post?
Well, we had a B camera on sticks, so luckily I'm using that a lot. But okay. So we got a good even ratio, but like I'm just never gonna roll on a gimbal. Ever again, unless it's a very specific shot.
How are things going with your movie, Nick?
Good.
Yeah.
So you shot your movie back in the fall/winter last year.
In the winter. Yeah.
Which is, I'm so impressed that you managed to shoot a feature film.
Still going.
Well, they always are. Yeah. They take a while. So like you're in the editing stages now?
Yes.
Assembly, so first cut, second cut?
Basically.
Tenth cut?
Yeah. So through June and July, the editor was doing her first assembly cut, and got that and had a little breakdown, as you do, you know,
because
it's
always.
Like, it's very far from what you want.
God.
Yeah. And like, especially on an indie thing, because like you're scrounging for time and there's like very specific things that happen on set where you're like, okay, as long as we do it this specific way, it's not in the script, but we need to do it this way. And I can like fudge this and make it work. Cause you know, as an editor, I think of, as you do and you do how to shoot for your edit.
Yep.
So none of that translates though to the editor sitting through all the footage. Sure. You know?
Oh, absolutely.
So
yeah,
all of August, basically every night I go home and just edit with this editor, and we're doing it all remotely through Zoom and through FaceTime, and it's working.
Wow.
So, and we're done. Like we just finished the last scene yesterday.
Oh, wow. Congratulations, man.
And thanks, man. So it's not done, but like I have now an out exactly like 90 minute film.
You have an edit.
Yeah, dude, and it's like it's like cool to see like, oh yeah, we shot that scene and that's what happens now. Like actually close. It's like cool, okay, it's a movie. But yeah, so I'm really close to the point of soliciting feedback from
Oh, that's awesome.
So yeah, you guys will see something soon.
What is send it to your, me?
This is a very broad question, but like, what has your experience been like directing a feature film? This is basically an indie, you guys kind of scrounge the budget together. It's basically you and the rest of the team just going and just making it happen.
Yeah, we were just like, we foresaw that there would be a deficit of content, like narrative content, through COVID, because there is. Mm-hmm. And most of the stuff being made is documentaries or really big budget or just like, hey, we made this movie on Zoom. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, and like that's like quickly losing its novelty, I think. So hopefully in the American film market and then in the European film market, we can sell this thing. So, and you know, we weren't trying to, the thing is thrillers and horror movies, they sell really well.
Yeah.
Like people always want that kind of content. Cause there's a weird, I think, voyeuristic draw to it. Like that's why serial killer things do so well. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, we decided to make one of those and we accomplished it. I mean, it's pretty cool. It's pretty intense. It's like one intense scene after another, but I guess as a director, my takeaway would be, I think I've said this before, less is more in almost everything. Like, don't try to do too much. And most of the directions I gave were just like, do that, but less. Like, you know, so that I think is valuable though to know. Like, for anyone, you know, stepping onto a set, you know, intensity doesn't always mean quality. So, and it can be very jarring, especially in a feature film when like you can build up to that intensity, but like you need to like take your time with things and like build up slowly. So I don't know. It's been a learning experience, man.
I mean, every single one.
Yeah.
How close is it to your vision? You know, what you saw in your head when you're reading the script slash like starting to shoot it?
I think pretty close, man.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, I think we managed to pull it. We were able to achieve, like, we didn't have to cut back on any of the locations or like change the script too much for like those kind of material constraints, because COVID was actually kind of a blessing. I mean, it was really annoying having to direct and have everyone in masks and like do all this, the briefings and the testing and the COVID safety officer on there, you know, but we got hella locations for really cheap. Everyone wanted to work. They were just bored. So they're like, yo, I know my rate is really expensive, but like, give me this and I'll do it. Cause I just want to be on set. Like I want to do something. And like, we got like some really great locations that would have normally been hustling, bustling businesses, and they let us shoot there for cheap. And yeah, it played in our favor overall.
Wow.
So I don't know, man.
We'll see. Like that's what the best like filmmaking happens, in my opinion, is when you are capturing not just like your story, but like a moment around you that lends itself and flavors that story in a really unique way. Yeah. Whether it's like you said, you know, locations for cheap, so to speak, or things that otherwise would be hustling and bustling, or like if you're shooting out in like nature and like it rains one day, and you're just like, screw it, let's shoot in the rain. And something like this scene takes on a whole new life and the spontaneity because of it. Yeah.
Yeah, man. Those things are beautiful. Like those little things that you can't plan for and just happen. So that's the cool part about being on an indie thing, is because you kind of don't have a choice to have that stuff happen. It's like, well, if it rains, we don't have any other options. So. Oh man. So yeah, it was cool in that respect. I sat down last week and showed the cut with temp music. So I spotted with my, hopefully who's going to be the guy composing this, if we can raise the money. And, we picked out a bunch of temp music that we like from other films. And I edited that into the current edit, and showed the co-producers, Chris and Kika, who also are the actors, and Chris wrote it. She came up with the story. So it's like the three of us are kind of the team here.
Yeah.
And they were getting very emotional watching it, which was really cool to me. That's to awesome. See. I was getting emotional because they were getting emotional. Like, I was like, damn, okay, this is really cool. Like, especially because he wrote the bloody thing and he's still like invested in it, you know? And like, they're like, obviously know exactly what went into it, but they could still like view it from an outside perspective. That was cool. So that was like a little bit of like, it was like a success kid moment.
That's really cool. So, yeah.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah, that's such a good feeling.
Yeah. What was one of the biggest takeaways or lessons that you learned, like, as a director?
Oh,
that going into it, you didn't really expect to learn.
Oh boy.
Or are there like a lot?
Yeah.
Always take the lens cap off.
Always take the lens cap off.
It's a good
off.
One. Remember that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Remember, it's usually in your back pocket.
It's usually in Sam's back pocket, actually. Yeah. That's what I've learned.
Yeah. Here's a lens cap on set. Just go talk to Sam. Even if he's not on your chair.
It's probably Sam has it somewhere.
Dude, there are lens caps from 2005 in his pockets right now, I swear to God. Dude.
Wears an old pair of pants back to the studio.
What's this? It's like a jangling of plastic when he walks in. No.
Oh, God.
I think, honestly, like, what took me a while was, and this might just be me, but it was like just letting people do their jobs.
Yeah.
You know, because like I've always shot my own stuff. I've always like, you know, shot, directed and edited and usually been doing the lighting and usually been the screenwriter before that.
Mm.
And that's how all of us kind of function. So mm-hmm. It was kind of weird at first to be like, wait, you mean I just stand here and I look at the screen? And then I look at the actor's performance. That's all I do. And like, I have the script. Oh, cool.
Reminds like, them of that's sweet.
So that took me a while to get used to. But like, it's like, oh, that's why that's done. Yeah. That's why like you don't like just do everything yourself, even though it feels really good to be like, yeah, I did everything myself, you know?
Yeah.
It's it was definitely nice to learn that, like, I don't know, just the ability to like step back and let people contribute their own things, and like everyone did, and it was great, and you know, something I knew but I hadn't really like experienced from that position before. Mm-hmm. So but yeah, and then honestly just tone it down. Tone it down. Mm-hmm. That's a big one, like, yeah. You know, just yeah,
the worst is like when you like, I just need a moment of this character looking at the other person.
Yeah.
And you go through it, and it's like, I can't find a single moment of the person. Dude. Just looking at the other person.
Yeah.
Do you remember when we were filming that? I won't name the particulars of this, but there was one scene where we were filming and we had a guy that was playing the president for something.
Yep.
And we needed him to say one line. Yep. One line. And he just kept committing to it like it was stagecraft and like it was the most dramatic. It was for a montage, and all we needed was the line of the President of the United States saying something like, issue the order, something super simple. Yeah. Like that. And he was like, issue the order. And they're like, no, just say issue the order. And he's like, issue the order.
Yeah. Oh my God.
We're like no, like, just say it like it's intense. You're the president. Mm-hmm. Of the United States, and you're giving an order to somebody else to issue an order.
And then the camera stops rolling. You're like, all right, how would you say it? Say it right now. He's like, issue the order. You're like, yes, do that. And then the camera rolls and he's like, issue the order.
So we had the guy that was playing his like one of his secretaries in his cabinet actually say the line, because he like couldn't.
Dude,
wow. It's so awkward, and yeah, you have to do that in front of the actor.
Oh,
on set.
Oh man,
like they know they yeah. know exactly what's yeah. going on.
But
like,
why couldn't he just say issue the order?
Like, why? That's why you film the rehearsals. I'm like, okay, let's just do a quick warm up. Let's walk through the lines. Can you just read them, please? Okay, issue the order. Okay, that's the
yeah.
take. The
yeah, that's right. It. You're already done.
Before he's overthinking it.
Give this guy his $100 and let's go.
And that's real, man. If an actor starts overthinking it, that's where you're just never going to have a good time. Because
yeah,
and that's where directing is. Another thing I learned is like, you can kind of direct yourself into a corner sometimes. Mm-hmm. If you try to get too in it.
Yeah. Because
then you'll really get in the actor's head, and then they start feeling like they're not doing a good job. And actors, like, God bless them, but they're very, like, you know, focused on, like, how am I looking and how am I right. sounding?
Yep.
And if they feel like they're not doing well, they're letting everyone down, then it's like you can have a bad situation. Luckily, that didn't happen too much, but
yeah,
it was.
Sounds like you had people that knew what they were doing in your
yeah,
shoot.
I think so. And, like, luckily, the two main actors in it, it's a very small cast. They knew the script like the back of their hands, so it wasn't like I had to remind them of the lines or anything.
Mm-hmm.
It was just yeah, some of the supporting actors, definitely we had that. We had to get them there for sure. But that's, it's a cool challenge, man. It's really fun.
It's weird. I always end up over directing people too. Like, cause I like to explain my idea behind what I'm trying to do. It's like, no. Mm-hmm. And don't like, I also try to be like, try to allude to what I'm looking for sometimes, like metaphorically. It's like, mm-hmm. you know, imagine you're out, like, you know, I don't know, trying to get something like, I want you to look like you're having fun. Like, imagine you just hit the perfect wave surfing and there's like, oh,
yeah, and then like, you see it. Him drifting away. Yeah.
But almost universally, like, I always reel it in at the end with, after you've gone through the scene, you've given a whole bunch of direction and you're like, I got it. It's really all just been rehearsal for what's the actual take, which is, all right, just give me a special. Just do your thing. Yeah. We got a good take. Just play with it. Have fun. Just do what you want to do. And I want you to go, you know, make it feel different than what everything else we filmed. And suddenly you get something spontaneous. You get something natural. They're having fun. They're committed. They're not in their head anymore. And then you actually get your good take right there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely. It's a, that's always a fun gamble. It's good. Because sometimes it's like crazy, but yeah, I've used that one a couple of times from you. Yeah. There's a lot of techniques.
Yeah, the special, you get some special stuff with the special. It depends on, it depends on who it is. Say, huh? It depends on who it is. If you have a wacky character, like, who's just going to do something that's totally outside of the context of the scene, then, you know, your specials might not work, but depends.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's the key in having good acting.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Yeah. They would know, ideally, what the character wouldn't do.
I always think back to, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Oh, no,
I was just
going
to say, I always think back to when we were filming Rebel Blades and Lawrence Newman playing one of the soldiers. And these guys aren't actors. They're just like war recreation guys. And these are the guys that are like into playing the Redcoats in Revolutionary War recreations, which is like, that's such a specific, like, boy, you guys are like really nerding out hard, you know?
55th Regiment of Foot, Nico.
Yes, that's right. They were good too. They were great.
They
like when you had them play their characters that they LARPed all the time, you know, it's like they were really good. But, you know, having specific reactions to moments, that's acting. That's real acting. And that's not necessarily something they practice. You know, they practice being in character and like improvising stuff. But it's like, I need you to, you know, you get shot here by an arrow and you react to it, you know. And like, that's one of the things where, so we're talking to Lawrence, like, you know, you're going to do this thing and an arrow's going to go through his face, right? He gets shot through the cheeks with an arrow. And, you know, your face gets stuck in an expression of like, whoa, holy shit, combined with, oh my God, I just got shot with an arrow. And he's like, okay, I think I'll try this. You know, he kind of like works on it. He's like, I'm going to go work on it for a little while. And he literally goes and walks off on his own. He just practices making a facial expression for a while. And he comes back and goes, all right, I was thinking I could do this. And he just goes, like that. And I'm like, that's perfect. He's like, okay, cool. And then he walks off again. And then he practices just literally making that one expression over and over about 5 minutes until it's time to shoot the shot. And he comes and he just nails it on the first take.
Nice. Nice. Right.
Yes, I love this. Like no BS, no acting school, no, you know, I don't know, therapeutic, emotional feeling stuff. Just pure mechanical. I'm going to move my muscles through this formation.
That's so funny. The worst is when they go off for 5 minutes and they come back and it's terrible.
Yeah.
Well, that's the overthinking it, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, man. There's so many Joey Tribbiani jokes happening. If you know your friends' references.
Yeah.
Anyway. Whew. Well, what did we talk about? Is there anything else we want to go over?
Nah,
we covered it all. That's it.
This is everything,
guys. We covered it all. We shot a video. We got okay. There's two things I didn't want to talk about that are coming out in over the next few weeks. One is Ren's solar panels video. The other is Son of a Dungeon. So more on that on the podcast as we move along here. But
solar panels video has been what, like a 6 month or 6 month, 6 week production, 8 week production. That's a big video.
That's a big video already. Son, yeah,
Matt, you've been in it.
Yeah, me and Ren have been working pretty closely on that for the past month or two. It's 2 months.
Or two or three something.
Four. Something like that. yeah, and it's we're definitely making great progress on it. But yeah, it's something that like is constantly being iterated on as we're editing it and working on it. So it's like, oh, this is like half of this video is now a completely different thing. And it's just constantly
Are you done filming voiceover for it?
Oh, yeah, we did. Yeah, we actually did finish that. Ren's working on getting the cut in of that. So, hey, look at that.
Look at us combining a little bit of work check-ins here with the podcast. Yeah, this is what it's like, everybody. Yeah. If you've ever wanted to work at Quarter Digital, this is what it's like, just without, you know, the microphones.
I'm just going
to
call you and go, hey, man, how's it going? I have one more thing to say. Son of a Dungeon, should we tell people the official date? Because we're planning to tomorrow And so I feel like we should say it anyway.
Do it.
All right, 2 weeks. September 29th. Son of a Dungeon. First episode.
Dun, dun, dun. It's not just the first episode.
And if you're subscribed to the site, you get episodes 1 and 2.
That's right. First 2 episodes dropping on the site.
And you know, we gotta drop that first episode on YouTube to get people knowing what they're missing, you know, that whole thing.
Yep.
And then we're gonna roll them out weekly thereafter. And our boy Daniel, bless his heart, he's going to take a break from Crew Cuts episodes because, my God, the kid's produced over 90 of them.
Yeah. Wow. God.
So many.
That's insane. He hasn't had a season break yet. So
hashtag make Daniel stop working.
Dude, hashtag turn off Daniel's computer.
Dude, forced vacation.
I aspire to have like Daniel's dedication. Yeah. Like he keeps me on the straight and narrow. So yeah.
So he's going to take there's going to be a season 1 Crew Cuts break, and then season 2 is going to start as Son of a Dungeon comes to a close.
Hey, if you're listening to this podcast on YouTube and you've made it this far, I would like you to leave some appreciation. Oh, assuming you're also a website subscriber and you watch the Crew Cuts there, I would like you to leave some appreciation for Daniel in the comments below. Tell him a favorite scene, a favorite episode.
Guys, D in chat for Daniel.
Yeah. It's about time. I mean, obviously there's cool comments on the website, but he deserves some love. And on YouTube, you get all this exposure, you get all these views, and on the website it's much more focused, and you know, it's amazing people who have subscribed on the website and really enjoy our stuff, but we need to show them a little bit of that YouTube love too. So shout out to Daniel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
get it. Let's get it. All right, thanks for joining, everybody. Until next time. Oh, we're going to do a premiere when Son of a Dungeon episode 1 comes out. We're going to do a YouTube premiere / website premiere / recorded live podcast where we react to people's comments, talk about the scenes. It's coming out. It's happening September 29th. So adios, amigos, and c'est la vie. And I don't know what else to say, but we'll see you on the next one.
Messed up the outro.
It'll be replaced. Now we're done. Now we're cut.